Well, we'll turn to those verses in Habakkuk. So if you've closed your Bibles, you might like to find that place again. Habakkuk chapter 1, beginning at verse 12. I guess most of you have probably had the experience of sitting down in front of a computer and trying to get it to do something that you know how to do and that worked fine yesterday, but that somehow today inexplicably does not behave in the same way. You're confident that you're doing all the same things, and yet somehow the computer is not doing what you want it to. Now, we know, of course, that computers are programmed. They always do what they have been programmed to do, and yet it doesn't feel like that, does it? So often we don't recognize the thing that has changed that means that it doesn't do what you expect. I use a different keyboard layout that's supposed to stop me getting RSI, apparently. And when I occasionally forget that or sit down at a computer that doesn't use that keyboard layout, then I start typing and gobbledygook appears on the screen. And it takes me those few minutes to realize that it is, of course, entirely my fault, not the computer just randomly deciding to spew out rubbish. And sometimes life can feel the same, can't it? That we look at what's happening around us and we think, well, this isn't what happened last time. This isn't what I was expecting. This isn't how things are supposed to go. This isn't how God is supposed to act. This isn't what I feel like I deserve or expect from God. That's certainly Habakkuk's experience here as he comes to God with what the NIV calls his second complaint. So we looked a few weeks back at the first part of the chapter where we saw Habakkuk coming to God and saying, the nation is corrupt. The nation is sinful. The law has no effect. Everybody does what they want to do. Nobody is following your ways. God, why are you not doing anything about it? He came and he said that to God, and God replied and says, I will do something about it. I'm going to send the Babylonians to punish those who do not follow my law, those who do not obey my ways. So Habakkuk's complaint is answered by God, but he now comes back to God and says, well, now hang on a minute. That's not really quite what I meant. You see, these Babylonians that you're sending, the cure is worse than the disease. What you're sending to deal with the problem is worse than the problem itself. You think the Israelites are unjust and lawless? Well, the Babylonians are so much worse. How can this be better? I think given that God predicted in verse 5 that Habakkuk wouldn't believe what he was being told, that God would send the Babylonians, I think we have to assume that a bit of time has passed in between verse 11 and verse 12, and that actually the Babylonians are now rising up as a power. So when that first complaint came, nobody expected the Babylonians to be a threat. Nobody expected them to come and conquer Israel. But I think this second complaint comes from a context where they're massing on the borders, where Habakkuk can see them coming, can see and now remembers that what God said would happen is indeed coming to pass. And so he goes back with a fresh set of questions. So the them of verse 12, who have been appointed to execute judgment, who have been ordained to punish, that's the Babylonians. That's a reference back to verse 6, the Babylonians who God said he would raise up. And so as we consider his response to God, we're going to see something of the character of God in the opening verses, and we'll see the character of the wicked foe as we continue on, and then we'll come to that key question in verse 13. Why, God, are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? And we'll return to the end with a few thoughts on Habakkuk's attitude. So we'll see God's character, the character of the wicked, the key question, and then Habakkuk's attitude. So the character of God, and Habakkuk begins here by praising God. He says in verse 12, Lord, are you not from everlasting? Not that he's actually doubtful. He knows God is from everlasting. It's not really a question, but for rhetorical effect. He's asserting what he knows to be true. God is from everlasting. God is the all-powerful creator. And more than that, he is my God. Habakkuk trusts him personally. My God, my Holy One. He recognizes the power and the authority that God has. And in that context, he can consider the trustworthiness of God's promises. Because he's seen that God is from everlasting. Because he recognizes that he is my God, he can say, we will not die. Because he knows who God is, and he knows what God is like, and he knows the promises that God made to his people. He knows that God promised a descendant of David would sit on the throne in Jerusalem. And therefore, he cannot allow all the descendants of David to perish. He can't allow the entire nation to be wiped out, because that would be to break his promise. We cannot die. Jesus, who would eventually come to reign on David's throne, needed to be descended from David for God's promises to be true. And so whatever may come, the destruction cannot be absolute. Habakkuk knows this. We cannot die. So in the midst of the doubt and the uncertainty and the pain that he's feeling, as he looks at the troops massing on the border, he begins by rehearsing and affirming what he knows to be true. He starts from the character of God, from what he can be confident of because God has revealed it. And we would do well, wouldn't we, to practice our ability to do likewise, to start in the difficult situations from, I know what God is like. I know who God is, what a character he has revealed, and go from there to the situation in which we find ourselves, rather than, as we so often do, beginning with our difficult circumstances and trying to deduce from that what we think God is like and ending up with a God whom we don't want to have anything to do with because we think he's unloving and will not take care of us. So we need to do as Habakkuk does and start from what we know of the character of God. He moves on then in the second half of the verse to look at the broader strokes of what's happening. If the Babylonians are going to come in judgment, then he recognizes that that judgment is not outside of God's control. This isn't a surprise to God. This isn't something that's happened and God is having to deal with it. No, God has decided. God, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O rock, you have ordained them to punish. God has decided that this will happen. What seems to Habakkuk like a terrible situation, something that he's baffled that God can allow, nevertheless, he knows that God is permitting it. He knows that must be true. He does not allow his knowledge of God's character to be damaged by this difficult circumstance. He sticks to what he knows. And the first part of verse 13 gives the last part of his description of God's character. And here he's starting to express something of his confusion. Back at the start of the book, he asked God, why do you force me, Habakkuk, to look on injustice and to tolerate wrong? And here he goes even further. He says God himself cannot look on evil and cannot tolerate wrong. Now, of course, that's not to say that God can't see evil things happening in the world. We know that God sees all things, and we know that evil does happen. The word here that's translated look upon means more than just seeing. Okay, and you can see that from the fact that it's parallel with the word in the next line, tolerate. So to look on evil is the same as to tolerate wrong. For the Hebrews, the word that they're using here as look upon very often carries this sense of approval, of permitting, of saying, yes, this is a good thing. So to look on it is to approve of it, to say it's okay. And that is what God cannot do. God cannot approve of evil. Of course, the implication is that therefore God should not permit this manifest wickedness to come about, any more than he could allow the wickedness of God's people to continue unchecked in the earlier verses. So God has promised that he will address the wickedness and injustice that Habakkuk presented in chapter 1 early on. But in addressing that, he's caused a bigger problem, because the solution, as we've seen, seems so much worse than the previous problem. the solution involves these wicked people. And therefore Habakkuk is saying, the solution you're offering, God, that solution is tolerating evil and looking on wrongdoing. Why is that okay? Why are you doing that, God? And we'll return to that question in a minute. But before we do, let's explore the character of these wicked people. The wicked foe, as verse 15 calls it. So verses 14 through 17 lay out Habakkuk's complaint. I think we tend to assume, don't we, that back then, 2,500 years ago, that life was hard, that people were brutal and unpleasant to one another, that that was the norm, that everybody did it, that nations would go to war over minor things, that there would be widespread death and destruction and famine and disease. And of course, much of that is true. In many ways, it was a hard and brutal time. And they did all do horrible things. That is what life was like. But that's not all that was true. That's not quite the attitude that the Bible gives us, is it? Because Habakkuk certainly seems to think that the Babylonians are worse than some other people, specifically worse than God's own people. Verse 13, the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves. And he goes on to give examples of their behavior. So he talks about the Babylonians, this wicked foe, pulling up their victims, pulling up the rest of humanity with hooks as if they're fish in the sea. And I think the picture is probably meant to be the practice that was popularized by the Assyrians, whereby you take people captive in war and you get a hook and you stick it through their lower lip and you chain those hooks together and you drag your chain of captives along back to your country as slaves. It's brutal, it's unpleasant, I can see you wincing and I can understand. But that is what they did, and it was a very effective means of controlling the people who they'd captured. So that is the picture that's being used of what the Babylonians are like, that they've taken this practice of the Assyrians and they've adopted it wholesale, and they are dragging people along by these hooks. So they entrap their foes with the hooks and the nets. And this is kind of a fishing metaphor, isn't it? Of the sea creatures being hooked up and dragged up. But it is also how ancient warfare happened, that they did drag captives along with hooks. And indeed, they used nets in battle as weapons to fight with. So this is both a fishing metaphor and a military picture as well. But I think more than this behavior, which was quite widespread, we move on in verses 15 and 16 to what I think has to be the heart of the problem, because there we see their idolatry. Consistently, the Bible presents the worst of human behavior not as the terrible things that we do to one another, but our attitude to God. It is worse to reject God and worse to worship false gods than it is to kill and maim and destroy one another. And so because their nets allowed the Babylonians to live in luxury, because their weapons allowed them to take captives and to have an easy life with their slaves on hand, because they did these things, it says he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. The Babylonians are worshipping the instruments of destruction. And the same is similar in earlier verses. Where have I got? Yes, back in verse 11, when God is speaking of the Babylonians, he describes them as guilty men whose own strength is their God. The Babylonians are puffed up with their own importance. They're treating themselves and the tools that they use as if they are gods. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't tend to burn incense in honor of the source of my food and drink. But it is actually quite easy, isn't it, for us to end up being controlled by the source of those things. To end up governed by what we see as providing for our needs. To act as if where our money comes from is the most important thing in our lives. It's easy for us to forget that the sovereign God who can raise up nations in judgment is perfectly capable of providing for us isn't he? That our comfort does not come from the money that we earn, but from the God who allows us to earn it, from the God who gives us the means of receiving that money from whatever source it comes. And so in this respect, I think we are like the wicked foe often, that we treat the source of our comfort as our God. We make it the most important thing in our lives. And if you think Habakkuk's just overreacting here, that he's puffing up how bad the Babylonians are, well, have a look back over the verses that we read a few weeks ago in the first part of the chapter, because God's own description of the Babylonians is just as brutal and destructive as Habakkuk's description. Verse 8, their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence. God is very clear that the Babylonians are not a nice lot. And so we have these Babylonians. We have them wicked in their behavior. We see them misattributing their own success, treating it as something that they've achieved rather than something that has been allowed to them. We see them worshipping their weapons, worshipping their own strength, rather than recognizing that it is ultimately God who has allowed them to flourish. Remember back to verse 12. God has appointed them to execute judgment. God has ordained them to punish. But given this character that we've seen of the Babylonians, given this picture that we have of what they are like, of how they behave, of the attitude that they have, it is understandable that Habakkuk is baffled, isn't it? If you want a modern day example, then consider the behavior of Nazi Germany putting people into concentration camps, or of ISIS today. Consider how you would feel if God said to you, I am raising up ISIS to punish you. That's the kind of idea here, that these terrible, wicked people who do awful, despicable things are being allowed to punish God's own people. It is entirely understandable that Habakkuk thinks this is wrong. This is unacceptable. It can't be allowed to go on. You see, whilst this is the justice that Habakkuk demanded earlier, back at the start of chapter 1, Habakkuk is expecting judgment for the people, but his issue is with using the Babylonians to provide it. This is a fresh injustice to his mind, because Israel had got very used to God rebuking the other nations, to God punishing the peoples around them. Indeed, they got used to God using them to do it, using his own people to punish the nations around them, using his own people to drive out wicked people. And in fact, even the demise of the northern kingdom, even the fact that that massive chunk of God's original people had been taken off into exile by the Assyrians, even that still hadn't shaken their confidence. Because they knew God had promised a descendant of David would sit on the throne in Zion. Nothing can come to harm them because God has made that promise. But what they've forgotten is that just as much as punishing the nations, at the very same time when God made that covenant with David to have a descendant sit on the throne, he also warned them that there would be severe chastening for the descendant who violated God's law. He told them there and then, I will discipline him if he does not follow my ways. And that is what's happening now. So the Israelites shouldn't have been surprised that God was coming in judgment because they've broken his covenant. So God is doing exactly what he told them he would do. They shouldn't be surprised that he's coming. They should be surprised that it's taken him so long to do so, that he's waited until now to come in retribution. So when Habakkuk speaks of those more righteous than themselves in verse 13, he's not saying he can't be saying that the Israelites are themselves righteous in an absolute sense. All he's saying is, we're not quite as bad as the Babylonians. But we have to consider, don't we, what God's judgment is designed to achieve. The Bible talks about judgment at different times in different ways, doesn't it? There's a difference between the judgment which people who reject God will one day suffer at his hands at the end of time, and on the other hand, the judgment, the punishment, the chastisement that God exercises in discipline on his own people. So this here is not a judgment of eternal condemnation. It is a consequence of their sin, but it is not final. It is not complete devastation. It is not eternal in its effect. Rather, this judgment is designed to be restorative. As the best of discipline and punishment should be, the objective is to come back into relationship with a renewed heart and mind. So the experience of defeat at the hand of the Babylonians, even the experience of exile, is designed to be a wake-up call, is designed to demand that the Israelites return to God, that they come back and they worship him. This is the kind of judgment that the psalmist is speaking of in Psalm 119 and verse 71, when he says, "It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes." This is the kind of judgment that is explained much more fully in Hebrews chapter 12, the discipline of a loving father who is seeking to correct his children before they go further and further astray. And so from our later on vantage point, we can see that God not only raises up nations to execute judgment, but also raises up nations to restore his people. Because we know that God brings Cyrus into power to issue a decree allowing the Israelites to go back to the land. We can see that 60-some years in the future of where Habakkuk is now. So we see a better picture of God's care and providence and provision. We see that this chastisement is designed to be temporary. We see that it's designed to bring repentance, not destruction. And of course, we must be clear that the fact that God uses the Babylonians for this purpose does not absolve the Babylonians of responsibility for their own crimes, for their own wickedness. And we'll see much more of that in chapter 2, whenever the next part in this series comes. Now, as we consider this case of the wicked swallowing up those more righteous than themselves, as we see the Israelites who were a little more righteous than the Babylonians, we would be remiss, wouldn't we, to fail to consider the time when that was supremely true. The time when someone not only a little more righteous, but someone who was absolutely and objectively righteous was swallowed up by the most wicked of deeds. It might interest you to know that there in verse 13, both the wicked and those more righteous are actually singular in the Hebrew original. So the ESV translates, "when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he." And when we put it in those terms, it's a little easier perhaps to see where we're going. That God's justice, that God's love can allow even such wicked acts as the destruction of the one and only truly righteous man who ever lived, because it achieves his greater purposes. And in this context, we have to recognize that none of us is righteous enough in ourselves that we do not deserve God's punishment. Are we a little more righteous than those around us? Perhaps. But in ourselves, we are not righteous enough. We deserve not merely his chastening and his correction, but ultimately we deserve his eternal retribution, because none of us is righteous. It is only because God allowed his one and only righteous Son to be crucified by wicked men, it is only because Jesus gave himself up, that any of us may escape that fate. And so from our vantage point, we can see that what Habakkuk knows of the character of God and what he knows of the wickedness of the Babylonians and the judgment they're bringing are not incompatible with one another. We can see how the two come together to fulfill God's plan. We can see from our perspective 2,500 years later. But for Habakkuk, of course, he couldn't see how these two made sense. And so he did the only thing that he could do, the only thing that was right and proper in that situation. Chapter 2, verse 1, Habakkuk declares, "I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint." So Habakkuk stands in patient expectation that God has an answer to this incompatibility. Habakkuk stands knowing that ultimately there cannot be an incompatibility, that there isn't a discrepancy between what he knows of God's character and what he sees of the Babylonians. And so Habakkuk is questioning God, but that's okay because he does it confident that there is an answer, confident that what God is doing is right and just and proper. Habakkuk doesn't think that he knows best. He doesn't sit there and try and reason it out in the abstract on his own. He does the only thing he can. He waits humbly for a revelation from God. And this surely is what we must also do. We must establish what we know for sure of God's character. We must assess what we know of the situation, and then we should take that to God and seek revelation from him. Because we have a revelation from him in front of us this morning. We have available to us more than Habakkuk did. We have the answers to these kinds of questions. And so we don't get to demand from God that he tell us what's going on, but we do get to come to him humbly asking for understanding, asking for an explanation. And how full an explanation we have will vary from situation to situation. Job gets much less of an answer than Habakkuk gets to his question when Job comes and asks, why do righteous people suffer? But we have a fuller answer than Job does, written for us in the words of Scripture. So God has graciously answered our questions. He has told us everything that we need to know right here in his word. And that is our solution when we can't figure out what's going on. Pray and bring it to the Bible and see what God has to say. Let's pray now.